broadcasting from the campus of Salisbury University. This is WSDL Ocean City 90.7 FM, Delmarva Public Radio. It's time now for a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with host Harold Wilson.
In the fall of 1968, without at first realizing what was happening to me, I began living in the past. These days, when I reflect on this and add up the years that have gone by, I can hardly believe it. I have been living in the past for over 20 years. Living mostly in the past, I should say, or living in the past as much as possible. And now, right away, before I go any further, I must interrupt myself and say that I am not entirely satisfied with the phrase living in the past as a description of my way of life. It makes me sound like some kind of sad old recluse. But living in the past is the closest I can come to it. I hope that my meaning will become clearer as I go along. I should also say that when I say the past, I mean a number of past, a hodgepodge of past, a spider's web of past, a jungle of pasts. My own past, my father's past, my mother's past, the past of my brothers and sisters, the past of a small farming town, geographically misnamed Fairmont, down in the cypress swamps and black gum bottoms and wild magnolia bays of southeastern North Carolina, a town in which I grew up and from which I fled as soon as I could, but which I go back to as often as I can and have for years, and for which, even at this late date, I am now and then, all of a sudden, and for no conscious reason at all, heart-wrenchingly homesick. Joseph Mitchell, in his memoir, A Place of Pass, published in The New Yorker, February 16, 2015. Welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wilson. We generally think of living in the past in pejorative terms. Some sad old recluse, as Mitchell says, or someone who refuses to accept the present and the inevitability of change. But in fact, we all live in the past. We are the embodiment of the past. William Faulkner said it best. The past is never dead. It's not even past. And that's so true. We all carry the past with us. So in the face of life's inevitable change, how do we honor the traditions that have made us what we are and use them as the yeast to help us shape the future? My guests today are Bonnie Feldstein and Janice Marshall, and we're going to talk about the watermen of the Chesapeake Bay and how their great tradition can help build a better future for the Delmarva. Bonnie Feldstein is the author of 5 novels, The Sailmaker's Palm, The Eastwood Affair, The Tale of Dickie Short, The Island Woman, and The Ladies of the Seminary, which was published just last fall. In addition, she's published numerous articles. Bonnie is retired from a career as a professional fundraiser for a number of organizations and divides her time between upstate New York and Ocean City, Maryland. Janice Marshall was born on Smith Island and is the wife of a waterman. She currently lives in Crisfield, Maryland, and is a curator and preserver of the waterman culture. She has served with the board of the Chesapeake Bay Foundation and currently teaches in the Rhodes Scholar Program of the Crisfield Heritage Foundation. Bonnie and Janice, welcome to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition.
Thank you, Hal. I'm really glad to be here.
And I appreciate the chance to be here and just talk a little bit about the bay and the watermen and our little island. Thank you.
Well, thank you both for braving the elements and coming into the studio today. Bonnie, let me begin with you. Your more recent novels are about the lives of people in the waterman community in the Crisfield and Smith Island area. The Tale of Dickie Short and Island Woman. Tell us about these two books.
Well, both books are the same but very different. They come at the culture from a very different perspective. Dickie Short was a crusty old waterman who had lived his life on the bay, raised a family, or actually he was married. He never had any children, but he sort of adopted this great niece that he loved very much. And he lived a very long, sturdy, strong life, going out every morning, 3:30, 4 o'clock in the morning. And he caught crabs in the summer, and he oystered, as some of them might say, in the winter. So that was the man's point of view, and it was written in sort of a wonderful, sarcastic kind of way that was not offending, but just really got the point through of how wonderfully humorous these people are and how incredibly staunch they are in the way that they live. The Island Woman I wanted to do very much because it came at this from the woman's point of view. And I think that that's often left out of history and the writing here. And I do it in fiction rather than nonfiction because you can have so much more fun with the characters. And they are wonderful. And all of the people, all of the audience who lives here knows that if they get involved in reading it or the culture itself and meeting these people, everyone has a nickname. All the men have a nickname. And they will have that nickname until the day they die. They can be 100 years old, but they'll still be Jimmy, never James or Jim. And so the Island Woman looks at it from how these women have to face the hard life out there on the island and things that people don't really think about. And I'm working now on a third and last series of this Chesapeake, which will involve where their lives took them and what's happening today on the shore.
Well, these are novels, and so there is an arc to them, and we've got a plot, and there are people who fall in love and people who get disappointed, which is typical of fiction and of a novel. But there's more than that. I get the sense from reading at least these two books, I get the sense that you're trying to say something further than the theme of a kind of a traditional novel. What are you looking for to say about the waterman in these two novels?
Well, I'm taken by the fact that I indeed lived here. I lived in Salisbury back in the late 70s when Janice and I were just talking about that, when the Eastern Shore was still old time in the 70s. And then as I moved away, I always tell people I left the shore, but the shore never left me. It's been a haunting to me. But all my novels are based on what I call an issue. They're issue-based novels. And I write from a perspective of really what's the issue, and then I fill in the characters and the people and how they react to it. And the greatest issue and that burdens my heart these days is the fact that this culture is vanishing. And you have wonderful writers on the Eastern Shore or people that have come here that have logged in nonfiction the facts of the people and, you know, what a jimmy and a sook is, you know, what the difference of crabs are and how they function. And I wanted to do it in a very different way, using an issue, a real issue of what is coming at this culture, why it's disappearing, and then taking it forward.
I got somewhere that you're a New Jersey girl. Do you have, in addition to this area down here, you have some New Jersey in your history as well?
Yes, I am a city girl, born and raised. I grew up in New Jersey, right outside New York City. And I would say I lived a very privileged life. My father did very well, and he had lumber mills and mill works. And he was a very well-known man in New Jersey at the time. And I was exposed to so many different things in my life. And one of the little-known factors is that I actually danced and sang on Broadway. And I have lived a life that has just been full of wonderful different cultures, because the theater culture is different than another culture. So I guess I have been very lucky. But I can honestly tell you that being a Jersey girl, the greatest honor of my life was to be able to come down here year after year and little by little work with some of the people. And it wasn't until I went to Tylerton and met some of these people. Janice graciously, you know, invited me over there, and I felt such an acceptance. And to me, I will never have a greater honor than to be trusted and accepted into a society where the people are so incredibly wonderful.
And that's what generated your interest, mm-hmm, in the culture here and in the Waterman. But I understand your sense of the fisheries on the East Coast, mm-hmm, and or goes much further than just, and I don't mean just the Waterman. We're going to talk about the Waterman here, but right, then the Waterman, that you have an interest in the Gloucester fishermen up in Massachusetts and on. Where does that come from, Bonnie?
Well, maybe it comes from having three older brothers that fished. I don't know, but it's very funny because I do a lot of public speaking, and people always say, how can a Jersey girl know so much about fish and fisheries? But it's an interesting point of view, because fishing was really our first occupation in America. When the people colonized the country, it was fishing. They pulled the fish out to eat before they ever got even off the boats to go onto the land to farm. So fishing has been with American history forever. And I am very interested in the changes all over the country. My husband and I travel a great deal, and we go up to Gloucester. Gloucester, Mass. is the oldest seaport in America. And I see the changes there. And I've talked to a lot of people up there. It's the home of Gorton Industries. And I see what is happening coming from outside. You know, there are outside influences that are coming, and they're really crippling our fishermen or watermen here to be able to go out. The lobstermen are having their problems. The shrimpers are having it down in the Gulf and down in the Carolinas. And just to add to this, Smith Island really and Tangier Island really have a whole other little family. And Janice will talk about this later. But I've brought into the book how they're all intertwined and they're not different than each other. Down in North Carolina, I know Janice will be going down there. They, in fact, the families as they grew, some of them intermarried, I think, you know, the sons and the daughters. And they've kept their little places in history. But this part of history, make no doubt about it, Hal, is departing this country as we knew it, as the American kind of independent commercial fisherman.
We're going to talk, obviously, in depth about the Waterman, but tell me about the Gloucester fishermen and how does what's happening to the Gloucester fishermen overlap with what's going on the Chesapeake Bay? How do you find them similar?
Well, the one similarity to all the fishing villages and towns in America is the fact that it's heavily regulated, which is a good thing, And it's not a good thing because you have to have regulation to be able to trust your fish. But what's happened is that a lot of more foreign entities have come in and they're fishing these waters. And our fellas are paying sort of what I would consider onerous fees. These are not wealthy people. The watermen of America are not wealthy. They're not the ones making the money off of the piece of salmon that we buy at our food stores. And really, they're very sort of simple, and I don't mean that in any kind of denigrating way. They live a simple life, they want a simple life, and they really only want to make enough to make a living and have a life. But in Gloucester, I see it that they're not able to go out as far because of the regulations from the government is not allowing them to go, you know, more than I think it's 3-4 miles off. So, of course, to get some of them are. Now, Gorton has a lot of the really big, if you go up there, they're wonderful. The big trawlers that go out to the Grand Banks, which is, we all saw the perfect storm. And these men really do risk their lives. But nonetheless, that a lot of people in New York, where I do a lot of speaking, didn't realize, the Chesapeake is the largest estuary in North America. It is vast. It is huge. And these men that go out get up at 3 in the morning, 4 in the morning. Now, they're not out there on the ice because they can't fish or, you know, bring the oysters in right now. But they risk their lives just as much. If you've ever been sailing, and you're a sailor, I believe, on the Chesapeake, a squall can come up, you know, pretty quick. And so, you know, as a sailor, you trust the people that you sail around. They're going to watch out for you. Well, the watermen are the same way. They all know each other, and they know these waters better than any entity in America. And it's a little frustrating. I mean, a lot of the fishermen in Gloucester are Portuguese. They've come from Portugal. They're fabulous fishermen. And even, I mean, they're just, it's dwindling. And what's happened is tourism is coming in to take its place. And, of course, that's good for the fishermen because it provides the local seafood. But a lot of the seafood is not local anymore.
Well, you've tried to capture the culture of at least the Smith Island area, and I assume that spreads on both coasts of the bay among the fishermen as well. And I read Island Woman and the characters from the island in there, and I read Dickie Short and the tales of Dickie Short, and found them kind of fascinating. Janice, I wanted to ask you, how has Bonnie done in characterizing your home, really, in her novels? Has she done a good job? Has she captured Dickie Short effectively in this book?
I think so. It's a lot of characters that work the water, that live in small towns, that have this personality that he had. And I know one thing. She did me pretty good. A lot better than I am. You know, she made me sound really good. But anyway, I told her, I said, Bonnie, this is nothing new to you. We had a little experience together in Chrisfield. We hadn't been met too long. We had known each other, what? But had we known each other a year?
Couple weeks, we were working on the program.
It was the first time we were working on it. So I told her, I said, Bonnie, you've been around Chrisfield, ain't you? She said, no, I've not. I said, well, let's take a little ride. And I rode around the waterfront, and then I went, it's called a place down neck, Jenkins Creek, it's called, in Chrisfield. Used to have a lot of crab shanties and things, and we were riding down there getting ready to go over the little bridge, and Bonnie said, stop, stop. I said, oh, my God, what's the matter? What's the matter? She said, that's what I saw in my book. I've never been here in my whole life, but that's what I saw. And I said, I don't know about this. I don't believe in that coming back once you're gone, but I don't know about this one. I think I think she's been here before. So, I think she did a very good compliment on it.
Did you know Dickie Short?
I've known a lot of them.
Are you married to one?
I think Smith Island's got mostly there. Yeah, they got them there. But he was one. He He was not highly educated, but he knew the land, he knew the water, and he knew what would hurt it and what wouldn't. You know, and he stood up for what he seen was coming that was not going to be good.
And this is typical, is it, of the watermen?
A lot of people, you know, I'm not against rules and regulations, like Bonnie said. We all need them. I've had many speeding tickets going up and down the road because I didn't obey rules and regulations. No different than watermen working the bay or anywhere. You got to have them. I'm not against that. But, you know, a lot of people place watermen in this uneducated place that they don't think they know anything. But I'll put a waterman up against anybody when it comes to making a living out of that Chesapeake Bay. You don't just drop a crab pot anywhere and think it's going to be with crabs or oyster grounds or crabbing grounds even. A lot of places crabs don't go. You got nowhere to find them. So anything way under that water and somebody knows where it is. And watermen like to take care of the bay. That's their livelihood. And, you know, and you have people that don't appreciate what they have in every culture. But for the most part, I think the watermen love to take care of the bay, like to preserve it, you know, and like to save some back for the next season that's coming in. So
what are some of the constraints that your husband as a waterman has found?
Well, he is one that he can conform to anything. He is. I mean, he'll take it in stride. He's had times when I've wrote funny songs about it, when he got caught by the Virginia police, you know, or things like that. But that was Virginia's crabs, and he didn't have a license to go take them at the time. So he understood. He just paid his fine. And a lot of times, when you see crabs that are not ready to be caught, you know, watermen throw them back into bay because they know they're not ready. Same way with oysters. And a lot of the decline in oysters in the 70s was due to a lot of disease in the bay. I don't know where it come from, MSX and all this, you know, disease. But way back there, when John Smith found everything in the bay, there was not a lot of ships going from different ports all over the world. You know, you never know what's coming in.
Right.
And the growth. I remember when I was a little girl, if you lived near the water, you were low-class people. Well, who lives on the water now? High-class people. And it's so many people that live on the bay now, and I can't blame them. It's a nice place to be, but that don't help the water situation. So it's not only watermen, you know, with the depletion of the seafood. And, you know, it's a lot of different factors contributing to that.
I looked at the 2014 State of the Bay report done by the Chesapeake Bay Foundation. And they say a couple of things in that report. And I'm asking if this is your experience. One of the things they say is that the bay is coming back in terms of the water clarity, in terms of the grasses that are growing, that there's slowly an improvement in the state of the waters and the flora and fauna in the bay. And they say that the oysters are coming back fairly strongly as well, but that the crabs are having a problem. Is that your experience and the experience of your husband?
Absolutely. I remember when I was a little girl, we used to have a lot of grassy bottom, which crabs need, you know, to grow. And the water quality was a lot better when I was little. Well, during the 60s, 70s, people weren't paying a lot of attention to what they were doing. And you got to have grass to grow crabs anyway. That's where they hide when they shed, when they're soft. And I was talking to my brother today, and it's so funny you asked that, because he mentioned the very thing you just asked about. He lives on the island. He's in his 70s. He still has his Virginia license also, where he can crab in Virginia. And he was debating. He said, I don't know if to give him up or not. I think it's $600 or $700 a year just to have a Virginia license. And he said, I'm getting older now, and I don't know if I want to give them up or what I want to do. He said, the grass has come back so much, it's places you can't even crab where it's so much grass. So it just told me too much of anything is not good, and not enough of anything is not good. So we've got to find a balance there. But, yeah, I agree with the Bay Foundation. A lot of times I don't agree with the state of Maryland and the oyster restoration program they have. It's a lot of money that could be spent if they would listen to a lot of the watermen, because in the area where I live, dredging oysters is allowed, where you drag an iron dredge on the bottom, and like a farmer tills the soil. It stirs up the silt and things that settle on the bottom, and it moves these oysters. Oysters can't move once they start growing. They're there forever. So whatever settles on them, if they can't live in it, you know, they die. And a lot of that has got a lot to do with it. So I think if they could get together with some watermen and just come to a common place here, you know, a little bit of their stuff. And because the Chesapeake Bay Foundation has had a house on two learning centers on Tylerton, where I live, and they've been there since, 60s, 70s, 80s, and we've lived pretty well among them. And they bring school groups there, and you take an environmental group right on a little community island where people depend on the water for their living. You know, you'd think that would never be. But it's turned out to be a good partnership, and I'm proud of it.
So tell me a little bit more about the state's oystering program. I'm really not, I confess, I'm not familiar with it. What are they doing?
And should I confess too? I'm not either.
Well, this is tell me the little bit
what
you know.
What little there. Bit I do know. I remember years ago they used to have oyster buyboats. And there's no buyboats on the bay anymore that used to buy oysters. And in the spring of the year...
Well, now, you got to tell us what a buyboat is.
A buyboat
buyboat isn't a boat that you go by and buy oysters, is it?
The watermen would go out into bay and catch their oysters.
Right.
And the buyboats would be tied up to the docks or to a beacon. And on their way in home, they would stop to a buyboat and sell their oysters that they were buying for a company. You know, that would take them either to market or shuck them or whatever they were going to do with it. But each company would have a buy boat, and that's where they would sell their oysters. Now they're bought right into Chrisfield to the oyster houses. But that's what a buy boat was. But anyway, they bought oysters in the winter, and in the spring of the year, they would hire these boats to take the oyster shell and put back overboard, you know, which would create reefs and things for oyster larvae to stick to. And if you've got to have a healthy part of the bay to do that. And then, like I said, when the bay got in such bad shape, I don't know what areas it would, but I do know what little bit they're doing in the southern part of the bay. Tangier watermen have done great this year. They're just 10 miles up the bay from us. They've done great this year. They had a good oyster recovery program. And then the areas in Somerset and Dorchester County, they've had good oyster seasons. I don't know if it's because of the location or the dredging that's allowed to clean the bottom each, you know, whenever they work.
What about fishing, Janice? Is there very much fishing anymore? I mean, I read actually the book about Larry Sims, The Best of Times on the Chesapeake Bay. And they were talking about the pound nets, mm-hmm. are they called? For rockfish, and then they were talking about the shad fisheries. I think that's in the northern part mm-hmm. of the bay. What's going on among the watermen with the fishing?
The upper part of the bay has not had a lot of oysters. Years ago, that's where all the dredge boats and oystermen would go, and they would harbor there for the whole winter, up around Rock Hall, Annapolis, all these places. And the upper part of the bay has not had a very good oyster harvest, and a lot of their people, they do fish a lot up there. We have a few fishermen in the lower bay, and I think they do pretty good, but it's a lot of regulations on it. You know, certain times of the year, so many days a month they can work, and so many pounds they can catch, which, you know, they could make a living, but in my area that I've been used to, I'm not as used to fishing, but my son Bonnie talked about these islanders and different ones, how they would go up and down the bay and intermarry. Well, my daughter-in-law was born and raised in Rock Hall, Maryland. That's a little water town up the bay here. Her father
That's where Sims was.
Yes. Yeah. I knew him real well. That her father was a farmer and a waterman.
No.
So she grew up in that environment. And my son, when he got a boat, when he was old enough to get his own boat, they would go up to Bay and Harbor in Rock Hall. So that's where he met her, and he married, and they live in Rock Hall now. But when you said that, right, that's first thing come to my mind was Becky and Will. That's mm-hmm. That's how it happened.
But the shad, I understand, are not a commercial, are not commercially viable anymore.
Not now. I don't know why. You know, a lot of the watermen says these things go in circles.
Yeah.
All I can think of is Elton John's song, "The Circle of Life." But I've seen it happen on the bay. And I was talking to my husband the other day, because I know nothing about this stuff. And the other year, it was so many hard clams on the bottom, you know, out in Tangier Sound. And he was wanting some clam chowder. I said, well, you know where you get it. You go get the clams and I'll cook it. He said, it's no clams out there. It seems like, I said, have you noticed that when it's clams growing, oysters is not growing? He said, well, I don't know if that's got anything to do with it. But, I mean, like I said, take somebody smarter than me to figure that one out.
Right.
Well, I also, I'll pop in here.
Bonnie?
Yeah, for a minute. The demand has gotten huge.
Oh, yeah.
Dickie Short addresses the overdevelopment of the land,
right,
which is massive. The mm-hmm. people are coming here in Delaware, for instance, to retire. So you've had this massive soil movement and just people.
Oh, yeah.
So Maryland has become the crab sort of place to come. I mean, it's on their flag. It's everywhere.
Oh, yeah.
So people want more. So therefore, it's driving the fishermen and the watermen to bring in more. And that's not helpful because the crabs don't, some of them don't ever really get to regenerate as quickly mm-hmm. as they should. And who doesn't, when you come to Maryland this summer, it's crabs. You right. want to eat crab meat. And that's not been helpful either. Not that you're going to stop that, but
We're going to take a short break now, and when we come back, we're going to talk a little bit about Smith Island and the culture of Smith Island. I'm talking to Bonnie Feldstein and Janice Marshall. And when we come back, Janice will tell us about growing up in an island fishing or waterman community. Stay with us. We'll be right back.
From soaring exhilaration to the depths of despair, some of the peak experiences in music and theater are playing in the world's opera houses. And World of Opera brings you their finest dramas and most brilliant voices. I'm Lisa Simeone. Join me for World of Opera from WDAV Classical Public Radio.
Saturdays at noon on WSCL 89.5 FM, Fine Arts and Culture.
Welcome back to Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. I'm your host, Harold Wiltson. I'm talking to author Bonnie Feldstein and waterman culture curator and historian Janice Marshall. Janice, tell us, we've talked about the fish on the bay and crabbing, but you grew up, you were born and grew up on an island. An island that is a real island. It's not connected to the mainland by any bridge. Tell us about growing up and on that island. And I understand there is a uniqueness to the language on Smith Island as well. Tell us a bit about growing up on Smith Island.
Well, I can say one thing. It was different. If Bonnie had a come to the island, we'd have thought she was a movie star, because I tell her how nice she looks. I mean, women weren't didn't have access to makeup and grocery stores and drug stores, and we grew up eating ducks, oysters, geese. That was our living. And if I went to Crisfield once a year, I'd gone to a big city, you know, and that's considered a little town. And, well, I tell Bonnie all the time, she's a city slicker. But I'm so thankful that Bonnie found us, because she made us more aware of what we've got. I know everybody treasures living over there, and because sometimes I'll ask the kids with the Bay Foundation or different groups I talk to that have been to the island, and I'll ask them, I said, did you feel isolated over there? And most of them will say, yes, they did. They felt very isolated because they didn't have access to anything. But you ask an islander what they think, and they say it's their freedom. It's not freedom to break the law. We've never had cops and courts and all that. Never had them on Smith Island, because people have learned to live together and respect each other's things.
What was your school like?
My school was a little one-room school. I had the same teacher for 6 years. She taught we didn't have kindergarten because she didn't have time to have kindergarten. We had first grade through six, and she had about 30 kids to do all them different grades in it. No teacher's aides, no nothing. But I grew up going to a one-room school. And then we went to Yule. That was the other part of the island. Smith Island is three different islands.
Yule now is another town.
Smith Island is made of three different towns. It's Rhodes Point and Yule, which are connected to each other by road, even though they're not connected to the mainland. And Tylerton, where I lived, is only accessible by boat. So going to Yule by boat every day, we thought that was the greatest thing I ever, you know, we got off of Tylerton every day. And that's how I went to school. And then later on, you went mainland for your high school and lived with a family all week.
Oh, is that right? You didn't commute every day.
This happened in like the 70s or 80s that the kids got to go back and forth every day. But when it was first started, the kids had to live with Crisfield families the whole week and get home on weekends. Mm.
And there were, a little over 800 people or something on the island?
It might have been about 700 people.
Growing up. Yeah.
But now, I don't know if it's even 250 left. The young people, just like in any town anywhere else, you know, is finding better jobs. And a lot of the watermen are not encouraging their kids to be watermen because it's hard to make a living now. And, you know...
I was listening to a waterman not long ago who you can verify this for me. He was saying that it is just too expensive for a young person to become a waterman now. And he ticked off the cost of the boat and the cost of fuel and so forth. Is that
a young man gets married? You got to have a house over on the island. There's no rental properties, no apartments. You've got to have a boat. You've got to have a crab house. You've got to have a rig of crab pots. I mean, you're talking thousands of dollars.
Right.
And a lot of young men don't see the fascination. A lot of them would really like to work the water, but I don't think they think it's... I don't think they think it's available to them now like it was. Because, you know, the style of living now, you've got to have insurance. A lot of people work for retirement, and that's one thing watermen don't have.
Well, I think it's interesting because this waterman, and I apologize that I can't recall his name, but that this gentleman was also saying that you cannot get a license. Now that you have got to almost inherit or buy a license from someone who already has one, is that
Maryland is not issuing any more license for working the water, which I think is sad. It's not that many people need them, and so a lot of times when an older guy dies, it goes to the grandchildren or something like that if they want to work the water. Same way I was talking to my brother this morning. He was debating if to keep them licensed or, you know, because he'd never get them back again. I don't know if Virginia has the same policy. I'm not sure. But he was debating if to give the license up or try to sell them or you know, what to do. Because He's in his 70s. How much longer can he do this? That's hard work. My husband is 78, and this is the first year he's not been out oystering after Christmas because the cold gets to him now.
Is oystering physically difficult? I mean, a man, you said he's 78. Is it physically difficult, or is it mechanized in any way now?
Well, they have a lot of new equipment, hydraulic rigs that haul in the scrape, I mean, the dredges and the tongs. But you still got to stand out in the weather, you know, and he can't lift. So there's a lot of bushels of oysters, but his health is more than anything. But the older you get, I mean, look, let's face it, we're not like we used to be. So it's hard on. I remember reading an article of a man in Yule I come across. He was 80 years old and in Crisfield selling his crabs. This was years ago. So I don't know if they make them like that anymore.
Dickie Short.
Yeah, Dickie he might Short. Have been. But I mean, I thought it was fascinating that happened. And, you know, the watermen, sometimes I think maybe they're a little harsh and say things they shouldn't say to strangers and all, but I was wondering what Bonnie thinks. Have you ever found them, or just they're honest people, or what? What do you think?
Well, I think they're brutally honest, and I think that people that wander down there, I hang around a lot of times in the boat yards, the boat building yards, mm-hmm. and I go in the winter, so that's what they do. They're off the water, you know, and I've asked them questions, and they look at me like I've got 13 heads, but I explain what I'm doing, and they're really nice, and they have a great way of teasing you.
Oh, yeah.
And that is brutally, brutally honest teasing. But you have to be a big girl. You got to put your big girl pants on to go down there.
Yeah, I never did think to ask Bonnie what she thought of that. But I know, you know, like I said, sometimes it sounds like they're harsh, but they're really not.
Well, there was a man, you'll know who it is, I'm talking about, down to the where they used to bring the oysters in the winter. And I used to sit out. He's gone now. He passed on about 2 years ago. And he was a wonderful man who sat in this rocking chair for, I think,
yes,
ever.
I know who you mean.
And he started as a kid there. Mm-hmm. And I went down one day, and I just sort of took a deep breath, and I walked in, and he kind of looked at me weird. And I said, well, I'd like to sort of sit here and just talk to you for a while. So he pointed to this old rocking chair out on the deck, mm-hmm. there that I think had been there for 200 years.
Yeah.
And I kind of looked at it, and I thought, nope, when in Rome, just get in the rocking chair. And I sat there, and I have never in my life had more fun with a man, because he would start teasing me, because mm-hmm. he realized I didn't know a lot about it. And so that, of course, started it. But he's now gone, but he was there, and everybody knew him.
And mm-hmm. and the thing of it is, I remember seeing them chairs. They were like old recliners and things. And I've got this phobia about spiders. And the only thing, and when you said you sit in it, I'd just about die. All I could see is, wonder how many spiders.
I thought about that.
Well, let me ask you again about island life and being cut off, in a sense. There are sort of two things. One is the mail. You needed to get mail. How did you get your mail every day?
The mail boat goes every day, except when it's froze over. We call it, we're froze up over here. So the mail has not, they probably got mail this past Tuesday and they won't get it again. They might get it Friday if the weather breaks. But when you're isolated and the ice cuts off the boat traffic and you're depending on packages or anything, guess what? They're not coming. But it's so funny. I've had a chance to travel around different places and I met a guy from Maine. He ran the mail boat from Eagle Island, Maine. Mm. And we struck up a really good friendship. And I can say this, I've been privileged to do some of this stuff. I've talked with watermen from Louisiana, North Carolina. I've been to Massachusetts and Maine, Oregon. I got to go to Oregon last year. And they all, every time I've been on stage with any of these watermen or their wives, it's like we have a connection. It's like a family getting together.
Oh, sure.
I mean, I could just sit and talk to this one man. I'd never met him before in my life. Well, and we would just sit back and forth and just talk. I guess it's a little bond you got going.
Well, you've got a common language.
And, yes,
and you've
I
got
think
a common
so.
Experience that that makes you very compatible with each other.
I think that it's some kind of connection there. Sure. I don't know what it is, but it's sure. there.
So froze up. this is a week for being froze up. How did you get off of? I understand. You were on the island when you were frozen in. How did you get off the island?
It's so funny. We had company for the weekend come up to stay till Sunday or Monday, and they're from Harker's Island, North Carolina. They're watermen, and that's their lifestyle. But anyway, Saturday he got up Saturday morning. It was speaking of such bad weather. No way water is going to stand them 5 degrees without freezing over. So he said, we better get ready and go. And my husband went with him. So he got on the mainland, and I stayed behind. So here I was there. They left on Saturday morning. I was there Saturday, Sunday, Monday. Well, Tuesday, the icebreaker, it's called J. Miller Taws, I think that's what it is stationed in Chrisfield, Maryland. And that boat is stationed there especially for breaking ice around Wicomico River, Deal Island, and Smith Island. And he made his trip over and said, we're going to make a trip tomorrow. So all the island ferries, I think Bonnie has that picture, the icebreaker leading us out, because it's no way nobody could go. Mm-hmm. And but that's how I got over, because if I hadn't come then, I wouldn't have made disappointment, because mm-hmm. the boat's has not been back since. Right. And I remember, I think it was it 76 or 77, when the whole bay was 70, frozen.
77.
Yeah. The whole bay was frozen over. Nobody went anywhere. No boats for 6 weeks.
Except for a few crazy people off of Annapolis who thought they could drive their cars
on the
bay and went through. I remember. I remember that well.
And we've experienced things like that. And but anyway, the state provided helicopters for fuel and groceries. And but that's really the worst time I've seen for freezing up. But most winters has got about a week or two of freezing.
I wonder how
that's
many.
That's what we call it anyway.
That's very interesting to get your groceries by helicopter.
Oh, yeah.
On a very serious topic, though, what happens when you get sick? What happens when you're ill or crabbing and oystering can be a dangerous profession,
oh, yes.
and you can get hurt.
Oh, absolutely.
Doing those jobs. What happens when you get hurt or when you get sick?
Well, most of the time, watermen don't really go out when the bay's iced over because their boats won't break it. But anyway, you take a sleeting day or something like that. It's very slippery, but if somebody was to get hurt, if the weather is not too bad, thank the Lord, the state medevac can land in Tylerton. We have a place especially set aside for the helicopter. So if it's really an emergency, if it's not blowing or foggy or something like that, they can come and pick up patients.
I think you mentioned that in the Tales of Dickie Short when he had his heart attack.
That was in The Island Woman.
In The Island Woman, was it?
I was going to sort of say that, in both of the books I cover the mailboats, mm-hmm. And one of the things I found very fascinating, and I think this was in The Island Woman, was how you deal with your medications. And, you know, we just get in the car, we pop down to the CVS or the Walgreens or what have you, and that just isn't the case. And it all has to be written down. And I talked to the women that did that over there. And so every single step of the way, and then they started laughing at me, you know, I'm writing down. And then they said, and if you think medications are bad, you ought to go shopping. And this one woman had counted that she had held her groceries about 20 times from the time she got, you know, mm-hmm. from the food store, put it in the cart, took it out, got it to the dock, took it on the boat, got it off the boat, took it to her house, and then hauled it back in. I was so tired when I left there. And I've never, ever, ever thought, you know, I'm so happy I just can go to the car
go to
the grocery.
It's a little different.
Janice, I get the point, though, that... You are not and have not been just a calm little waterman's wife who sits, who makes sure that supper is on the table when your husband is ready. And one particular thing I remember about you is the island. Smith Island is eroding away.
Oh, yeah.
And not only is there a danger of losing the culture, there's a danger of losing the island itself. Oh, yeah. But you took a role in trying to preserve the island, as well as your role in trying to preserve the culture. What did you do? Tell us about your advocacy for building the dike.
Well, as you said, we are experiencing a lot of erosion because the soil is so sandy. Every time we have a storm, the bay eats in it, you know, big time. And when a lot of that marsh is gone, it just leaves the main part of the island where people are living, it's exposed. And our island was getting in the same shape. So years and years ago, we got together at the Ladies' Aid because a lot of these women discuss a lot of stuff over there. And I got a pretty big mouth myself. But anyway, we started a letter writing campaign. We wrote a form letter, and all they had to do, it had deer on it, but nothing else. And then it had sincerely on it, nothing else, but it had a letter in the middle. So each Sunday, we would copy off 7 letters for each person. They all said the same thing. And each person, each family would take 7 letters home, and we would send them to our state and U.S. senators, congressmen, and every week, everybody got all these letters into their offices, and it made a difference. And something we thought probably would never happen did. And we did get a little bit of diking around our island, and it's made it so much nicer.
Made a big difference.
The front is not eroding away at all. So, and in the back end, they put a jetty light, and we're trying to do that for the other 2 islands because they are closer to the bay than we are. And but the senators told us it said something. Every morning when they went in, here was piles and piles of letters. And it said the same thing every week. You know, that letter said the same thing, but it was addressed to them. And different people, you know, were signing it. So that was a little thing that we started, and it said a lot. So all it takes is a little bit of work.
A little bit of initiative.
Oh, yes.
That's right. And initiative took you also to working on the crab co-op.
I don't know if that's called initiative or not.
Well, it sounds like initiative
yeah,
to me.
Yeah, I guess so. I almost got arrested on that.
Oh, good. But tell us about, and you weren't even speeding, were you?
No, I wasn't speeding that day. Well, the women on Smith Island have picked crabs for years, and it's always a good product, and they have a lot of relatives on the mainland, so word spread out, you know. Like if my sister, I don't even have a sister, but I'm just giving an example. If I sent crab meat to her, she'd say, next time my neighbor wants 2 or 3 pounds. And that's how it started spreading. Well, I think, I don't know who it was, but complained that Smith Island was sending a lot of crab meat over, and they wanted the health department to do something about it, state health department. So one summer, they had confiscated a lot of the women's crab meat, but they wouldn't say anything. They'd just live shut up, you know, and not say anything instead of make waves. Well, one morning, I happened to be on the boat. My son had had surgery. And I'd gone home that evening and picked my crabs and come back the next morning to see how he was doing and bring my crab in. Well, say nothing more. Here was the state health department, DNR officers and all. And when I stepped off the boat, I'm not paying attention. I got to get out of the hospital. So this 2 men stopped me and told me they were going to take my crab meat. Well, needless to say, I put up a big fight over that. And I imagine you could have heard me to Salisbury that day because once he stopped me, I knew a way of life that these women had depended on was going to end if we didn't do something. And I threatened to throw him overboard, and I tried to knock him overboard with my hip. And DNR told me that if I'd done that, they would arrest me. And So anyway, it was an ugly thing.
DNR, the Department,
Department of Natural Resources. Yeah. But anyway, to make a long story short, I don't know what happened. The state got involved in it, which shouldn't have been done. Open up a Pandora's box. And it took 4 years, and I called my state senator, and I said, something's got to be done here. We need this money. I mean, that's the only source of income the women had to help get school clothes and things like that. So anyway, he said, well, Janice, you know, that's illegal what you do. I said, well, I know, but you can do something about it. He said, yes, I can. He said, I can't help you stay illegal, but I think I can help you go legal. Well, that was the worst thing he ever said to me. I didn't want to do all that. I wanted it to stay, because nobody likes change, do they, Bonnie?
No.
It's easier to do everything you're familiar with. But anyway, he helped me, and 4 years later, a lot of fussing and trying not to cuss, you know, things like that. Took 4 years to get a building there with a lot of grant money that they told us we couldn't get, you know, but I told them it's no other way to do it. We don't have a lot of money, and you're talking about a very small business. So they did. They helped us, and we're in a picking plant. And when that happened, like 20 or more years ago, we had 15 women on Tylerton picking there. And due to death and moving, we've got 3 women still keeping that co-op going. Mm-hmm. You know, we formed a cooperative, and I think that says a lot for women. Let me tell you something. Small cooperatives in the United States, for the most part, you can check this out. I don't know where, but you can check it, because I was told this by the guy that helped us in Washington. Most small cooperatives fail after the first year. Here we are, 20 years later, and you talk about a small one with 3 women still in it. Says a lot for the character of the women. And, you know, and the smartness in how to keep this place going all these years. And they've done it on their own after it was put there. Nobody's come in and helped pay any bills or anything. So we were just left there to fly, and we did it however we seen fit, and it's still going.
Well, let me ask you about one other phase of your work over on the island, and that is with the roads program. What are you doing with the roads program?
I'm so fortunate to be able to share with so many people about the culture and the traditions. And, you know, it's given me a chance to share the island and the culture of the women and the watermen, and tell a lot of the stories. And they all ask about traditions and customs. And believe it or not, I've had people from Scotland and England still remember traditions where they're from that we carry on today on the island.
Well, we're almost out of time, but I want to do just a couple of things before we go. One is I want to mention that Bonnie Felstein writes under a pen name, and if you look for her books, The Island Woman or The Tales of Dickie Short, you'll find the author is Anna Gill. And you want to look for that pen name. But I also want to say to you, Janice, that I understand that even though you do a lot of advocacy work, that you actually do cook now and then as well, and that you are famous for your crab soup. Will you've not published a cookbook, I understand. Would you give us quickly your recipe for crab soup?
Absolutely. Chesapeake crab soup. You take 1 pound of Maryland crab meat. You can't use anything else but Maryland crab meat, so you're going to have to get that when crab starts again. And I do it the easy way. Look, I'm busy, so I have to do it easy. Take 2 10-ounce cans of cream of crab soup, and fill 2 of them cans after they're empty with whole milk. Got to have a half a block of butter in it. It wouldn't be no good without a half a block of butter. Got to have that. Let's see. And then I usually put either 3 to 4 ounces of cream cheese stirred in it, or you can put a cup of sour cream. Bonnie's about to have a fit here. Then you cook that up until it gets, you know, going good. Don't boil it because it'll stick. And then you add your crab meat in there until it gets warm. You don't want to boil it. And but you got to have Merlin crab meat to do it.
Well,
that's very easy.
We're going to get that recipe from you and see if the radio station will put the recipe on their website.
Oh, and I did forget Chesapeake Bay seasoning, if you and, like it.
And, well, we'll
about a tablespoon of that.
We'll put the recipe on the website. And the final thing is, I understand that you sing, you cook, you sing, you harass your congressman. Get stuff done. Let me ask you if you wouldn't mind singing a famous song, Till the Storm Passes By.
Well, this is sung on the island when the women are in the crab house picking crabs. Your children are out running around in little boats. You know, they usually have a boat when they're young. Then the men are out on the water and a storm comes up quick. They have no other refuge. So this became our prayer for the men. In the dark of the midnight have I oft hid my face, while the storms howl around me and there's no hiding place. Mid the crash of the thunder, precious Lord, hear my cry. Keep me safe till the storm passes by. Till the storm passes over, till the thunder sounds no more, till the clouds roll forever from the sky. Hold me fast, let me stand in the hollow of thy hand. Keep me safe till the storm passes by.
Bonnie Feldstein and Janice Marshall, thank you for joining us on Delmarva Today, Writer's Edition. And thank all of you for listening. I'm your host, Harold Wilson.
In the dark of the midnight have I oft hid my face, while the storms howl above me and there's no hiding place. Mid the crash of the thunder, precious Lord, hear my cry. Keep me safe till the storm passes by.
You've been listening to a special writer's edition of Delmarva Today with their host, Harold Wilson. This program is produced on the campus of Salisbury University for Delmarva Public Radio. Christopher Rank is your audio engineer. Mary Seaman is the volunteer producer. Visit our website, delmarvapublicradio.net, for podcasts of this program.